Welcome to 35 West. I'm Ryan Berg, Director of the Americas Program at CSIS and host of the 35 West podcast.
With how professional the Mexican
but
government
are we ready? I don't reform think. Trends in Argentina.
Right. And that's what happened.
Role at all in the NAFTA negotiations.
Welcome to 35 West. I'm Ryan Berg, the Director of the Americas Program at CSIS and the co-host of the 35 West podcast. Looking across the hemisphere today, crime and insecurity appears on the march, with transnational criminal groups ascendant from Mexico to the Caribbean and the Southern Cone. In light of this, it is important to reflect upon the history of U.S. lax security cooperation, where we have seen two major multi-year security initiatives launched and concluded in the past 25 years. The first, Plan Colombia, and the second, the Mérida Initiative. Both involved billions of dollars in cooperation across a broad spectrum of sectors, from military and police forces to civil society and NGOs. Both also differed significantly in terms of their levels of success, while Plan Colombia stands out as among the most effective U.S. security initiatives in recent history, the Mérida Initiative struggled to achieve its goals and has been supplanted now by the pared-down bicentennial framework. As we look to the future of regional security cooperation, we are joined today by Dr. Paul Angelo, the director of the William J. Perry Center for Hemispheric Defense Studies at the National Defense University, and the author of a really excellent new book, From Peril to Partnership, U.S. Security Assistance in the Bid to Stabilize Colombia and Mexico. In this episode, we will discuss Paul's new book, the history and legacy of Plan Colombia and the Mérida Initiative, as well as what lessons can be applied to today's challenges in the hemisphere. Thank you so much for joining us today, Paul.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Ryan. Thanks for inviting me. I'm a big fan of the podcast, and it's an honor to be a guest today.
Paul, this book is really a terrific effort. You've put a lot of work into this, putting these two multifaceted operations in conversation with one another over the years, something we really haven't seen done before. Can you begin by laying out for our audience what the impetus for this project was? What drew you to this type of comparative analysis?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really comes down to the fact that I have had the unique experience of studying academically and then working professionally on the subject matter of my book, Security Assistance, and in the countries that are the two case studies for the book. And so I've been able to look at security assistance as a practitioner, as somebody who's in the policy universe, and then somebody who's spent much of his career in academia. And so having worked on the inside of it, first as a naval officer during my first 10 years of active duty service, I gained a much deeper appreciation of the limits of U.S. power, especially in Latin America, where it's so often assumed that the United States is puppeteering world affairs. And sometimes here in Washington, we also seduce ourselves into believing the same. But our partners and our adversaries have agency, and we need to recognize that. And policymakers should be adjusting their expectations of what can be achieved through things like security assistance based on a sober analysis of what our partners bring to the table and, in many cases, what they don't. I first visited Colombia during the first Uribe administration when I was a midshipman at the Naval Academy. And then I went back to live and work there in 2010, 2011. And the place where I was living in 2011 was so different from the place that I had experienced more than a half a decade prior. I wanted to know whether the United States and U.S. policy had anything to do with that transformation and the progress that I was witnessing. And as a comparativist at the time, the Mérida Initiative was in full swing with Mexico. And so it provided real fodder for comparison when I was still a practitioner in uniform. In fact, the U.S. government had even identified Plan Colombia as a model or as an inspiration for what we endeavor to do in Mexico. And so I think that the two case studies really lend themselves to comparison.
Colombia and Mexico faced severe security challenges at the onset of Plan Colombia and the Mérida Initiative, respectively. In Colombia, especially, there was a well-founded concern in the late 1990s that the government could fall to the guerrillas. Given these adverse starting conditions, the accomplishment of Plan Colombia are very impressive. What, in your opinion, were the main enabling factors that allowed Plan Colombia to get off the ground?
I think we have to dissect this in on the Colombian side, what enabled Plan Colombia, and then on the U.S. side, what enabled Plan Colombia. And on the Colombian side of the equation, Colombian elites, political elites, had systematically underinvested in the country's security forces over decades, especially its military. And in large measure, this was to prevent or guard against the possibility of coups, which were happening in many Latin American countries throughout the Cold War, particularly the 1970s, 1980s. So this left the Colombian military in a situation after the Cold War in the 1990s, in which the state's adversaries, principally the FARC and the ELN, the two main insurgent groups in the countries, had better technology, communications, and weapons than the Colombian state. Of course, they were also buttressed by huge drug revenues, and Colombia was and remains the largest exporter of cocaine to the rest of the world. President Pastrana knew that he had to make up for lost time, especially as the security crisis in Colombia became so acute by 1998, 1999. And for that, he knew he needed international support. As he said, he wanted a Marshall Plan for Colombia. But when the United States came to the negotiating table and said, we'll underwrite your plan, we'll help underwrite your plan, but we're going to start with the most basic obligation of government, the provision of security, Colombia thereafter took on a more militarized posture and became largely a security assistance mission rather than the development assistance plan that I think Pastrana had originally conceived. On the U.S. side, there was an overwhelming concern that a large South American nation, 3 hours by plane from Miami with Pacific and Caribbean coastlines and a stone's throw from the Panama Canal, would succumb to state failure, or perhaps even worse, revolution. And the fact that Colombia was also the epicenter of the global drug trade helped build domestic pressure here in the United States to do something about the crisis, as the sentiment in the United States throughout the 1990s and into the early 2000s favored supply side approaches for addressing the drug trade, as opposed to the demand reduction approaches that have become more popular and more prominent among the U.S. electorate in the last decade. And so it really was a question of how Washington would help Colombia address its problems, not if. There was strong consensus here in the United States and bipartisan consensus here in the United States that Washington needed to help a struggling Democratic partner in the Andes.
So Colombia faced an explicit challenge to the central government from the ELN and the FARC, as you said. But Mexico's security environment in the 2000s, and I would argue continuing to today, was one of more dispersed threats from a variety of criminal organizations. How did that difference condition the way that the Mérida Initiative played out?
Whereas Colombia faced a political military threat that sought to overthrow the state and a threat that only a stronger state could overcome, Mexico has faced dispersed threats that were largely devoid of political ambition. And we've seen an increase in political violence in Mexico of late, but it doesn't mean that the cartels or the gangs that are committing acts of political violence necessarily have political ambition. And so I would say that over the last 15 to 20 years, cartels and gangs in Mexico are mostly a law enforcement and justice issue. And the criminal objective in Mexico has always been to suborn and capture state institutions, not eliminate them. That said, military responses were deemed necessary to deal with a growing crisis of insecurity, but they were always meant as a stopgap measure in Mexico until the government could build a stronger federal police force. They were never seen as a permanent solution. And unfortunately, over the past 15 years, we've seen repeated attempts to reform federal police agencies, but every single one of them has failed or been discontinued. And more than 15 years on from the signing of the Mérida Initiative, Mexico's posture to confront public security threats is more militarized than it's ever been.
One of the insights from reading the book, Paul, is the role of the private sector. You've mentioned this already in our short discussion so far. How engaged were the Colombian and Mexican business communities in the two initiatives? And how did the differences there help explain the relative success of the two projects?
Thank you for that prompt, Ryan, because I think that Colombia and Mexico are especially instructive in helping build out theory on the role of the private sector in supporting and underwriting security sector reform. This is a largely unexplored theme in the body of both academic and practitioner literature on security sector reform and the transformation of security forces. In Colombia, you had a private sector that, due to the fact that elites were being targeted by the FARC and the ELN, had rallied behind government efforts to transform the country's security forces. Land and business owners in Colombia had already had an experience accommodating organized crime or privatizing their security responses. And we needn't look much further than the experience of the Autodefensas Unidas de Colombia, the paramilitary groups, to see the disastrous consequences of that approach. The Colombian private sector and other high wage earners in the country paid into something known as the Democratic Security Tax starting in 2002. And that Democratic Security Tax and the revenues that were collected with it more than doubled the Ministry of Defense's operating budget, which enabled investments in aircraft, technology, personnel training, and intelligence that made all the difference in the conduct of Colombia's counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, and state building campaigns. In Mexico, There's long been a distrust between financial and political elites because they've historically occupied different spaces in society, and their interests haven't always necessarily been aligned. And that's different from the intra-elite relations that we see in Colombia. Elites in Mexico were, for the most part, shielded from cartel violence, and the violence had regional characteristics that made it seem less like a national problem and more like a localized problem. And so in Mexico, private sector actors never paid into security and justice reform efforts specifically. Yes, they paid into it as part of their annual taxation, but there was never a coordinated effort to channel those resources directly into state security institutions and to give the private sector a say or an oversight mechanism to determine how those resources were going to be channeled, as there was in Colombia. We have a couple of subnational scenarios in Mexico and the states of Chihuahua and Nuevo León, where the private sector did take an interest and, in fact, tried to model some of the work that they were doing in coordination with state actors on the Plan Colombia model or the democratic security model in Colombia. And they paid into reforming state and local police and helped determine how the newly applied tax revenue was going to be invested. And it's in those cases, particularly in cities like Ciudad Juarez or Monterrey, where we started to see real reductions in reported crimes and the perception of insecurity in those territories.
A key takeaway I found from the book was that while facing down the challenge of an entrenched non-state armed actor is difficult, it is far from impossible. Still, effective security policy depends heavily on national and subnational politics. While it is clear that there were substantial differences in the success of both Plan Colombia compared to Mérida, could you talk about some of the success stories in Mexico? And have any of these best practices been carried over into the new bicentennial framework?
So my book is largely about institutions and institutional reform because I am by nature an institutionalist. And from that perspective, I believe that Mexico is really underdelivered. It's hard to even paint what happened in Ciudad Juarez and Monterrey as success stories today, particularly as we see violence once again on the rise, because the gains, the institutional gains, were not sustainable. As violence dropped, investments in the very institutions of the state also dropped. And this points to a major challenge in Mexico, the politicization of security policy. In the last 20 years, policies relating to violence reduction and insecurity have been policies of el gobierno de turno in power, the administration in power, not policies of state. And so there's little continuity from one administration to the next at the national level. And this replicates itself at three levels of government because Mexico is a federal system where there's inter-party competition at three levels of government. The ambition relating to institutional reform is also absent in the conversations about the bicentennial framework. And I think that may more than anything be a recognition of the limits of U.S. influence in partner nations. But the reality is that until Mexico's security and justice institutions work better and work better together, we're going to continue to face endemic corruption and violence that undermine democracy and foment instability in our most important partner in the hemisphere.
So you mentioned just now the importance, Paul, of institutionalizing gains. I think this is something very important that you highlight in the book, which means better training, budgeting, operational procedures. You mentioned Mexico. Can you give some examples of this type of institutionalization in Colombia?
Colombians realized that they had spent 10 years in battle and adopted new technology and ways of fighting, but that none of those innovations had necessarily been captured in their doctrine. And when Colombia put an end to the conflict with the FARC, as the Santos administration negotiated peace with the country's largest guerrilla organization, the military realized that it hadn't done enough to tell its story and then to sell its story to the people who held the purse strings in Colombia, the Colombian Congress. And so if it wanted to stave against a post-conflict budget reduction and stave against the real dismantling of a long-term transformation process of the institution, it was going to have to justify its expenditures, whether those were maintenance expenditures or additional professionalization requirements, not in annual cycles, but rather in decade cycles. And so the Colombian Ministry of Defense started to set their ambitions not 2 years into the future, but 20 to 30 years into the future, and came up with really robust plans to do long-term budgeting for the kinds of capabilities the Colombian military thought that it needed to develop for itself. And I think the Colombian Ministry of Defense took a really sober look at where they were, where they are, and where they wanted to be. And that informed the way they structured their education and training And more than anything, Colombia institutionalized the best lessons of Plan Colombia era, because they made major investments in their people and the people who comprised the Ministry of Defense. In Mexico, there aren't necessarily as many examples, and those examples aren't nearly as dramatic in terms of the effect that they've had on the country as we've seen in Colombia. But the introduction of new intelligence units in the security forces during the Merit Initiative has been one of the unmistakable wins. Sadly, the joint and interagency efforts that would really help Mexico take the fight to the narcos and hopefully win have dissipated over the years since the conclusion of the Merit Initiative. And so I think if we're looking at the most important institutionalization processes that occurred during the implementation of the Merit Initiative, I'd say the most important one has probably been the institutionalization of a working security relationship with the United States government.
Well, we've discussed the history of these two countries and these two initiatives for the episode thus far. Let's talk about what you see as some of the lessons of the things that you've studied for your book and what they might hold for the future in other countries in the region. One issue that is surely on everyone's mind today is what comes next for Ecuador, a country that's seen a massive explosion in violence and an uptick in homicide. Policymakers both here in Washington and in Quito have expressed at times a desire for a so-called Plan Ecuador to help curtail rampant criminal activity there. What, in your opinion, are the key lessons this book holds for U.S.-Ecuador security cooperation?
So, Ryan, one of the overarching lessons of my book is that our U.S. security assistance architecture for too long has abided by a one-size-fits-all approach. And then we wonder why our track record is all over the board. Stabilizing the Balkans is very different from what we're going to have to do in the short term in stabilizing Haiti, which is very different from what we did in stabilizing Libya. And so U.S. strategic objectives are not consistent across these contexts either. And I think too often we delude ourselves into believing they are one and the same. There's a temptation to do that with Ecuador today. A Plan Ecuador is desperately needed, as I most recently argued in a piece that I did for War on the Rocks. But Ecuador is not Colombia. In Colombia, we were dealing with a counterinsurgency, whereas in Ecuador, this is very much a counter-transnational organized crime mission. Ecuador is a transport country for cocaine, whereas Colombia is a production country for cocaine. And so the kinds of turf wars, or the geography of turf wars in Colombia and Ecuador look very different. And the tools that are needed to dismantle groups that are operating and influencing across the geographic terrain of each country look very different. And so I think more than anything, we should be looking to the best lessons from the Merida Initiative in looking at how we would evolve or adapt those lessons from Mexico for Ecuador. And there I would say a couple of lessons stand out for me. One of the key lessons of the Merida Initiative was that too often the kingpin strategy, which we pursued and sought to take out leaders of cartels and gangs, oftentimes made the problem worse. And where we saw the biggest successes in Mexico were in those instances in which financial intelligence was used to go after the actors in the country, some of them well-placed government public servants who were protecting cartels. Secondarily, I think we need to look for mechanisms for the Ecuadorian business community to underwrite and exert some oversight in the administration of resources that are being directed to help the Ecuadorian security institutions confront organized crime groups and gangs. Bringing the private sector into the conversation would facilitate the sustainability of any reforms or gains that are made, especially after any potential international resources that are being provided by the European Union, the United States, or other like-minded actors within the hemisphere are drawn down. And that's something that we saw in Colombia, which goes to the point that I made about the institutionalization of many of the gains of Plan Colombia through doctrine. Thirdly, the main lesson of the Merida Initiative is that the nature of the transnational organized crime threat requires participation from a whole of government. You need various actors across the spectrum of security, justice, and defense involved and coordinating with one another and ensuring that they're all on the same page. And the way that you do that is by building trust. And the only way that you're going to be able to build trust between institutions that have traditionally operated in silos is by conducting background checks on the people who comprise those institutions, but also creating interagency or joint task forces that enable the various actors of government, to include their counterparts in civil society, and the private sector to convene conversations and dialogue about the best path for the country to pursue going forward.
Paul, you direct the William J. Perry Center at NDU, and I would argue for Americans, this is a stroke of great fortune for us because you're a security expert and you've written this book and you've landed at the perfect spot for Americans and for American strategy. The Perry Center is the preeminent institution for educational exchange between the U.S. and regional militaries. So as you look back on the research for this book, what role do you see institutions like the one that you now direct playing in past and in future security assistance efforts for the United States?
Thank you very much for that question. And I couldn't agree more, Ryan. We are indeed the preeminent institution for educational exchange between the United States and our partners across Latin America and the Caribbean. And although my views in today's interview don't reflect those of the U.S. government, I feel comfortable in saying that the work that we do at the Perry Center is really trade in trust. We are a space for dialogue and big ideas. And I think more than anything, by convening movers and shakers from across the security, defense, and justice spectrum from nearly every country in the hemisphere for routine conversations and dialogue about how we confront shared problems and challenges with shared solutions, we are essentially fostering a strategic architecture for security cooperation so that other agencies or departments within the U.S. government can plug into what is a long-standing and large network of more than 10,000 alums that we have stretched across the globe.
All right, last question. Paul, is there something that we did not cover? Anything else that you would like to highlight or add?
Thank you, Ryan, for that question. I've been looking for an opportunity to talk a little bit more about the title of my book and particularly what I mean by partnership. Quite obviously, the use of the word partnership references the kind of bilateral relationship that the United States struck up with its Colombian and Mexican counterparts. But I think the book also details other brands of partnership that are equally important to underscore. First and foremost, Plan Colombia would have never been as successful were it not for the partnership among government agencies in the Colombian government. Colombia made a concerted effort to bridge the civil-military divide and enacted a whole-of-government approach to dealing with threats to national and citizen security. Likewise, I think we have to point out the partnership that developed over the years of Plan Colombia between the Colombian government and the Colombian citizenry. And there we see an increasing trust and faith and public confidence in the institutions of the state that cannot be overstated because it was so fundamental to the broader success that Colombia has had as a nation. And so from a U.S. perspective, we need to see partnership not just as a means to an end, the end being security, but also as an end in itself. And the partnership that the United States conferred on Colombia with the signing of Plan Colombia, which frankly was a risk for Washington at the time, you know, really enabled a period of international partnership for Colombia, in which Colombia was brought in as the first NATO partner nation in Latin America and the Caribbean and remains today the only. Colombia became a member of the OECD. Colombia earned a free trade agreement with the United States. And most importantly, from my perspective, is it something that I worked on when I represented the State Department in Honduras, the U.S.-Colombia Action Plan helps triangulate expertise between Colombian security, justice and defense providers, the United States, and partners elsewhere in Latin America, and frankly, the rest of the world. And so I think that it points to the value of partnership as both a means and an end.
Dr. Paul Angelo, director of the William J. Perry Center for Hemispheric Defense Studies at the National Defense University and author of a really excellent new book, From Peril to Partnership, U.S. Security Assistance in the Bid to Stabilize Colombia and Mexico. Thank you so much for joining us today on 35 West. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Ryan. Really appreciate it.
For you, thank you for joining. Stay tuned for the next episode of 35 West.